C7. Number 17B.
See, if we only take out one aspect out of the whole, say when I went through the term of mission, and we leave out just one aspect, say the aspect of love, then I see that my mission is not complete, that there is something which is not really whole, because then it's still open that I feel, oh yes, that's a mission, but it's only my mission, and therefore I will somehow live in an orbit of my own, untouched by the whole world, isolated. I better go up on the on a mountain in the Tibet and look up to the sky, or be a, what you call an Einsiedler, when you go into the desert or into where you are alone. A hermit, huh? I can become a hermit and say, oh golly, my destiny is to be a hermit all the way from the world, huh? Because I wouldn't see it as love. Can you see that an idea is never whole until we see it in its full reflection? Something is always missing, and therefore misunderstood. That's the objections that are brought forth. That's what would come in and say, I don't like that, this is not what should happen in reality, these are the objections. But all the objections fall when we blend an idea through the seven. Yes. Therefore, we could see that what is necessary here is really the pure understanding, an understanding that takes in every aspect. This sense of every aspect being brought in is brought out in the chapter towards the end very clearly. On the last page of that chapter, we have the following statement. It says, I and my Father are one. It's interesting to see not the Father and I are one. It's I and the Father are one. The part is one with the whole. This is the subject, that we have to see that the part is not the part, that the part must be integrated into the whole in order to be really a real aspect of the whole. I and my Father are one. That is, one in quality, not in quantity. One in quality. Therefore I can see every idea, the I, is in quality one with the Father. And we have seen that actually, that every idea has the power of the Infinite One, every idea has the substance of the Infinite One through creation, at the chapter of creation and the law. I've seen that. Therefore that the idea is in God, qualitatively as big as God, qualitatively. Then I was always fascinated with the next statement, as a drop of water is one with the ocean. See, as a symbolism for I and the Father are one, a drop is one with the ocean. A ray of light, one with the sun. Even so, God and man, Father and Son, are one in being. Well, what does it mean? See, if an idea is one with the whole, then it gathers the quality of the whole. It loses its quality as being a part, which means that through relationship, it gathers more qualities. This is a terrific point in the Gestalt theory, that we can see that through being one with the whole, something gathers more qualities. I was always thinking this way. I said, well, what's the difference? If I have a drop of water, or if I put all those drop of waters together, and it is an ocean, what's the difference? Is it not just an accumulation of drops? Is not an ocean just a heap of drops? Or are new qualities created by it, alone by the fact that they are related to each other, that they are brought together? Are not more qualities being created without having more drops of water? And I could see, oh yes, this is really the Gestalt theory, which says that, or the synergy principle actually, which says that the whole is much bigger than the sum of its parts. So the old concept of the Greeks were overthrown. The Greek says the whole cannot be bigger than the sum of its parts, but that is not true. That is not true, you see, because when I put all the drops together, I can have a boat floating on the ocean. I can't do that on a drop of water. If I put them all together, I can have fish in the water. With a drop, I can't do it. If I put all the drops together, I can have a real strong wave. As single drops, I can't have it. It is showing that relationship creates qualities. We always were thinking that parts have qualities, and that therefore if we investigate something through the parts, and we're investigating what are the parts, what are the qualities of the parts, what is their nature, that if I would analyze the parts, that I would have the answer for the whole. And I don't have it. Because the immaterial relationship, the fact of relationship, which is nothing material, see, a relationship is nothing material, is one of the biggest thing we have in reality. Relationship form qualities, create qualities. It's actually the relationship that are important. Just as we have seen before, if the various organs of a body are not properly related together, I don't have a body. Then I don't have a bloodstream, then I don't have pulsation, then I don't have a nervous system, then I don't have a digestion, then I don't have anything. All that is essential for the body is actually brought about through relationship. And can you see why in modern physics they begin to see that it is not the particles, whatever the particles may be, either as quantums or as energy, are actually important, that the universe consists of relationships. We can hardly think it out and what that means. But in this example we can. We can already fathom that actually creation is creating relationships and not creating things. So that the whole becomes bigger than the sum of its parts, because the whole is then all the parts plus the relationship. And that plus is really that which gives more qualities to the parts. So that the notion is something very different than a lot of drops. I and the Father is one. I, if I see the I related, infinitely related to all the qualities, that must gather terrific power. Just as when all the rays of light are gathered into the focus, just by relating them properly into a focus, you get heat, and if you put somewhere a newspaper at that focus, it begins to burn very quickly. it can create a fire. Can you see? So a ray of light is one with the sun. We can, just can somehow feel that the relationship brings really the whole being at the point of having terrific impact and terrific power. Yeah. All right. Now, we have stated as point 11, we have stated the oneness and the duality. And then we come to the law, to state the law. We actually are a bit in a difficulty because all what we can say is that oneness really consists of the infinite reflection of idea. So as a law we can perhaps put here, every idea reflects every other idea. Every idea reflects every other idea. Then you ask me, how can you elaborate it? Well, infinitely. There is practically no more. You see, that's the point, huh? That it gathers so much, that so much new qualities are being brought forth, that practically it's no use to start. The only thing we can say, whenever you will contemplate an idea, let it reflect through the seven. Have the seventh by seven. So the whole exercise we can do here is always to take whatever comes along and take an idea and blend it with all the other ideas of all the other synonymous terms. Then we elaborate this law. And one can see what an enormous impact this will bring. To see that every idea is related to every other idea. What more do we want, really? It's actually at the point of absolute transparency where we see the purity of understanding, where everything is clear. So here I'm not in a position to say now we substitute God for, or substitute the seventh synonymous term for God. Here we can only substitute all the ideas for the term idea. And that is infinite. We get an infinite reflection. Yeah. The chapter itself, therefore, does not so much show how this blending looks like. It much more states, you have to blend it. You have to see an idea in its sevenfold way, or there will be an objection. Something will be misunderstood. Something doesn't make sense. And the second main point in that chapter is to show what is it that could prevent such a pure reflection. What prevents it in our consciousness that we are not constantly thinking along that blending of ideas. For instance, she says in mind, you see, she says in mind, what is it that prevents it? She says, that what prevents it is if you start to think out things humanly. If you bring in human opinions, instead of, you see, can you see, instead of having ideas that reflect themselves, we bring in human concepts and try to reflect themselves. And all what we get is a mortal calculus. We calculate with opinions, we calculate with human concepts instead of ideas. And don't we do that very often, right at the beginning, that we start out humanly with a human conception? Then she goes further and says in spirit, what is it that usually prevents that pure reflection? Or what is it that prevents that we can see something in its purity? And she said, it's usually that you don't really distinguish between a material concept and its spiritual concept. Like man, see, that you say, man is the idea of God. All right. Do I distinguish between man as idea Or do I see man as a mortal and call that the idea of God? You know? That's so easily done. That I have a statement, man is the idea of God, but do I actually consider that term man already spiritually or still materially? And so often, you know, the student thinks, oh yes, man is the idea of God, but he thinks about man, about the person, about his patient, or anybody. So it has a human man as the idea of God. And that naturally brings in the distortion already. So she said, be aware that which tries to deflect is that your concept of a term like man must already be pure, must already be absolutely spiritual, and that you have distinguished between the material concept of a term and the spiritual concept of a term. Or then she says, what hinders also pure reflection is that what we like very much to do in soul, that we say, is this attitude sustained by the testimony of the physical senses? If I go along in my consciousness about the health and of somebody, the perfection of somebody, do I ask suddenly, can I see that the patient is healed, or do I still see that he has fever or not? I ask the testimony of the physical senses to support my understanding, my spiritual understanding. So I can build up in consciousness a pure reflection, and then I interject in soul a wrong element and say, is this supported by the testimony of the physical senses? Yeah? See, these are the things she brings in. Or, in principle, usually what comes in as that which distorts that pure reflection is that we build up in consciousness some kind of a pure reflection and then ask ourselves, does that conform with my sense of Christianity, of religion, of dogma? Absolutely pure on the level of a spiritual science? Or do I compare it with a religious sense? And that happens only too often. That we build up a new concept of an idea in its all its purity and so on, and then we doubt it because it does not agree with the general trend of the church, or general trend of a movement, or the general trend of a whole religion. It doesn't fit into the general trend of Christianity, or it doesn't fit into the general trend of an ethic, and then we say, it's not right. So we have to be very careful that we don't interject other principles as a measuring rod. Or in life, she will bring in life, you know, that she would say, be careful that what you entertain in this wonderful sense of blending an idea, that you don't do that for the love of a material purpose, for the love of materiality, that your attitude is also pure towards it. So that we don't build up something in its purity and then find out that behind it is actually a very material motive. Is actually perhaps a personal motive, a love for matter, a love for material success, that it is motivated by something that is not purely of purely love, small l, purely directed to the spiritual. Then she brings in another, in truth, she brings in another aspect where we have to be careful that we keep the inner consistency of something, and that's a very interesting thing. The only time she brings it in here in this chapter, that she brings in, your logic must be consistent. Your logic must be consistent. It must not go against a logic, must not be illogical. You know how often that comes in? Under that inconsistent in logic comes usually in under the term of common sense. Spiritual things usually contradict common sense. But common sense is regarded as a kind of logic. And therefore, when it does not agree with common sense, we begin to doubt it, begin to feel there is something is not right about it. It should conform to common sense. It doesn't. Christian Science is not common sense. It's very good if in practical life Christian Science uses common sense, but not really as a demonstration of Christian Science. There we will find that we will see things which do not agree with common sense. Because what is common sense? Common sense is a human concept of truth and of right, and not the divine sense. And then, as a last subject, Mrs. Eddy will bring in that wonderful sense which we have been taken as the part and the whole, where she says, be careful that you do not destroy the inner consistency of your understanding just by considering the part and not the whole. That's one of the points where we fail so much. We consider the part and not the whole. You know what that means? You know very well what that means, you know? It means that we usually measure an experience, any experience what we make, either positive or negative. We measure it usually as in the framework of a very small part. Namely, usually in the framework of perhaps today. How I experience it today. And today, you say, it has given me a lot of pain and a lot of sorrow, and it has given me a lot of hell, and it was a bad day. Within that one day, the frame of reference says to that demonstration, it is painful. And if we broaden it out a little bit further to a month, and the pains are gone, we feel that was not really an important problem. And we have nearly forgotten it. And then if you consider it within the framework of 10 years, you look back and say, that was the best thing that happened at that time. That really shook me up. That really gave me a kick into the pants, and I woke up and I really began to turn around, and this was really the day. And suddenly that whole day is a beautiful day. Suddenly it's a very important day. Suddenly it's a very valuable day. Yeah? And perhaps seen in the framework of 100 year or 1,000 year, it even takes on another evaluation. Can you see? We have to see that in blending these ideas and considering a situation in its all ramification, that we are aware that our system of reference in which we consider it is big enough. How big? To be as big as I and the Father are one. To be as big as God. Certainly not so small as a day, or a body, or a family, or a business. Certainly not so small as 10 years. It should be as big as being itself, and say, what is its place value in the whole of being? Then we get the true perspective on it. And we get the perspective on it which says, it is always good. It can't be anything else but good, when seen in the whole, in the system of the whole. In the system of the whole, never anything happens that is bad. Never. It's impossible. It's impossible. In the system of reference of the one being, there is only one. And that's good. And therefore, seen within the reference of I and the Father are one, we really see that every incident gathers wonderful qualities through relationship with the whole. Those relationships, those qualities which we would not see when we consider it in that little frame reference of today or of my body today, or of my business today, or my family today, or my husband today. Isn't it terrific? Can you see how this whole chapter builds up a wonderful sense of bigness and shows it creates only new and good qualities the moment we put everything into the whole of the one being. Our whole life, you know, our whole life would gather a terrific momentum, a terrific bigness, if we would put the small into the big, if we would put the part into the whole. Therefore, whatever happens, yes, I know I'm just as human as everybody else. One is perhaps annoyed. One is irritated. All right. But at least we know a method to get out of it. We at least know that when I get quiet and sit down and say, now, what is it all about, that I know the method. That's at least what we know. We know the way. And it's a terrific thing to sit then down and say, now, my little problem, are you actually a problem? Huh? Are you actually a problem? Or are you going to bless me? And if I look at it, I will see that it blesses me. I only have to spend the frame of reference wide enough and big enough to see its place value. Because we know that Christ is also that which wounds to heal. Christ which says, I wound to heal. So that wounding is healing. So that wounding is a blessing. It's only a matter of from which frame of reference do I look at it. If I look at it from the frame of reference of a body that has nerves, and that gives me a lot of pain, then I certainly say, this is not agreeable. But if I look at it from the wider frame of reference, I see this was necessary in order to wake me up and to shake me up and to change my attitude and to find a new standpoint and to look at things differently and to rise above the mortal sense of things and to widen up our vision, and so on, and so on, and so on. And a whole lot of new qualities are being created. And I feel I can only be blessed by it. This is some objections answered.